or maybe you're just hearing voices in your head. It's the Mike Novak Show, the only program of its kind on this green earth as far as we know, though we have crews out there right now with little tiny podcast catchers trying to capture another show just like this in the wild before they go extinct. Oh well, let's sing.
Good planets are hard to find. Temperate zones and tropic climes. And true currents and thriving seas. Wind blowing through breathing trees. Strong ozone and safe sunshine. Well, good planets are hard to find. Good planets are in demand.
And welcome to another edition of the Mike Novak Show. I'm very happy to have meteorologist Rick DiMaio back on the program today. We're going to discuss some weather and climate phenomena that have happened on the planet this year, like the wettest May ever, yes, you heard me right, ever in the United States, plus a couple of early West Coast hurricanes, and why all of that stuff is happening. But before we get to Rick, I'm going to start with a conversation in a car wash. Yes, you heard that right, too, with Earlene Howard, who is the chief cook and bottle and recycling container washer for something called Collective Resource. They go to homes, businesses, organizations, and restaurants in and around Chicago, picking up their food scraps. So those food scraps can be turned into compost, which can be returned to our soils to enrich them and lower the amount of carbon that goes into our atmosphere. Unfortunately, for some reason, people are more terrified of touching food scraps than they are of ruining the planet with greenhouse gases. Go figure. I'll talk to Earlene about that and the award Collective Resource just received from Green America and the grant she's supposed to receive from the state of Illinois, which might or might not happen thanks to budget deficits and a stingy governor and other things. And all of that happens right after this.
Could an app be the answer to a better garden? Absolutely. It's the new free app, Homegrown with Bonnie Plants. Note, track, and photograph your garden's progress. Personalize your weather and reminders. Get variety info, grow guides, hands-free dictation, and more. The Homegrown with Bonnie Plants app, the sharpest tool in your garden. Download it free on the App Store.
There's still time to enjoy the May-June issue of Chicagoland Gardening Magazine. After all, it's still June. The three main stories are about three gardens that are going to provide you with inspiration for years. One is in north suburban Chicago, one is west of the city, and the third is in South Bend, Indiana, so there's no playing favorites here. And each brings many different elements to the table, including what one of the gardeners calls the New Wave Perennial Movement, I've got air quotes around that, based on the work of Dutch garden designer Pete Udolf, who's been on this show, and who is responsible for Lurie Garden in Chicago's Millennium Park. There's also the case of the gardener who, a lot like you and me, learned lessons the hard way. Speaking of doing things the hard way, there's my column on the inside back page. Chicagoland Gardening Magazine, a publication of state-by-state gardening magazines. Go to chicagolandgardening.com. But if you're in other parts of the Midwest or the South, try one of the 21 magazines in those regions by going to statebystategardening.com or call 888-265-3600, 888-265-3600. All right, I've got to set the scene here, which is a car wash somewhere in Chicago. The location shall remain a secret for the moment. And on one side, we have cars being washed. And then on the other side, and in fact, when I walked in, I didn't even see you guys. on the other side of these vans that were parked here are a bunch of buckets.
Orange buckets.
Oh, that, they are orange, mostly orange. You got some white, and you've got the green totes. And how big are those totes?
32 gallons.
And the buckets are 5 gallons, right?
And the buckets are 5 gallons.
And I'm looking at this person who's dressed in an orange T-shirt that says Collective Resource, Inc., Compost Education and Services. And, of course, it is the owner, Earlene Howard. And it's wonderful to talk to you.
So nice to be here, Mike. Thanks for having me.
And congratulations, because you just won an award from Green America. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so we were part of the Spring People and Planet Award. There was 10 companies, organizations that were nominated to be winners of that award, and they gave awards to 3 organizations, and we were one of them, and I'm so excited.
So what did you get, and what are you going to do with it?
We got $5,000, and what we're going to do with it is we're going to find our own space so that we can move out of the car wash.
Well, and that's a really interesting point, because let's back up then a little bit and talk about your business. And I've known you for several years, and what you're doing is really remarkable. It's something that we should have done as a society long ago, which is figure out what to do with our food scraps. But you finally did. Here we are. And why is it you have to be in a car wash with these containers?
Well, I think that when we came into the car wash 1.5 years ago, it was kind of the idea that it was going to be temporary. We've had, you know, we've been a smaller company, and we've had a lot of different solutions. I mean, the first initial bucket washing happened in my basement in my laundry room.
And how many buckets were there?
Oh, maybe 15, 20. Then there were 30. You know, then I found another solution. There was actually a guy that wanted to do them in his basement. And so we would drop off the containers with them, and we already had the 32-gallon totes at that point. That's when that started. And so we did that for a while, and then he got too busy where he couldn't do them, and we were looking for a place to go. We went into just a neighborhood, like a residential garage for a little while with a garden hose and an alley sewer, and we did that for a little while, and then we came here 1.5 years ago, maybe a little bit more, with the idea that it was a temporary solution, that we were going to figure out something different. And I continue to look for the right type of space for us. We need the floor drains, which is one of the things that makes the car wash ideal. And in this type of weather, it's actually a pretty good solution. But in the wintertime, this is not a great place to work. It's not warm. The water's not warm. It's warm enough so the water doesn't freeze. But that's not saying a lot.
No.
And I would like to get some automation. I think that's our next step is, I'm looking at commercial-grade dishwasher possibly for the 5-gallon buckets. That was part of what I had applied for with the UFSCRAP grant that we got awarded in April of 2014. But now some of that funding is on hold. And so,
well, that's a whole nother story, too. All right. And we'll get to that in a second. But let's get back to where we are in this car wash. How many containers do you have here?
Oh, right now, there are probably close to 80 32-gallon totes here right now. We've got 2 trucks that just unloaded between 20 and 25 each. And then there's a supply of what we call event totes. We keep a supply of these totes that aren't in regular service, so that when we're out with the public standing over the can working, you know, we wanted to have some totes that weren't used as hard.
And how many vans does it take you to schlep all these over here and get them washed?
Well, we don't just bring them here to get them washed. We use the vans to do our routes. So every morning, the vans start with clean containers, enough to do the entire route. And then we go to each customer and drop off the clean container and pick up the full container.
Well, I guess we have to back up there, too, because for folks who are not familiar with Collective Resource, explain why you have this company and what exactly do you do?
Yeah, so I wanted to compost, and I did not have a good way to do it because I live in a condo building. I didn't have any way to do it in my yard. I didn't have any space. So then the light bulb went off in the fall of 2009 that if I made composting easier, more people would do it. And I went to research and find a path, and then we were able to start in June of 2010. Diverting. So I had been talking about it for that time frame while I was trying to figure out how to actually make it happen. And I had a handful of people who were like, I'm going to do it as soon as you have it figured out. And we just kept, it was pretty much word of mouth. I give a free pickup to any of my customers that refer another residential customer. Or if they
for how long?
One free pickup.
Oh, one free pickup, okay.
One free pickup. And then if they get like a school or a customer that goes into the larger containers, then they get more than one free pickup. Depends on how many containers they place. So I really count on people sharing the story and spreading the word.
You started picking up
the 5-gallon buckets in my car.
5-gallon in your car.
Right.
And were you doing it just residences, homes?
Right. It was just residences. Well, no, that's not true. We had a unicorn coffee shop in Evanston came on really early. And so we were doing that too. And then we did a trial program with Tweet Let's Eat on Sheridan Road. We actually did about 3 months with them in buckets in my car to get a taste of what the restaurant industry looked like. And then we stopped until we got the van and we got the totes and everything. So that was, kind of an initiation. It took us 6 months to do our first ton. And all of that was pretty much lifted by me, picked up by me, put in the car, tipped by me. And so, and all of the buckets were washed and, there's not a job that I ask anybody to do that I haven't already done.
You've added a new meaning to the phrase ground level here.
Yeah, it's very grassroots and I really wanted to. The only thing was it needed to sustain itself, and
in the beginning, were you making any money doing this?
Not really, but in the very beginning, I had other work that I did that fed me. But then there was kind of that in between time when the company really needed my full attention, and it wasn't really sustaining me. But now it does.
So how did you get past that point?
You need a lot of customers.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you know, how much extra do we make over the cost of running one truck, and how much does that support? And then if you take that times two, you've got two trucks, and then the little bit of extra that comes off of that, then, you know, all of a sudden there's a modest income for the owner to keep running the business.
I met you several years ago, and you were trying to make this a going concern. And I'm looking here, you've got 1, 2, 3, 4, at least 5 workers here.
Right, and I just sent a 6th worker off with the 3rd van. So we only have 2 of the vans here, and one of the vans is going off to Lober Motors to get a little work done on it. So.
But obviously the business has grown enough where you can hire people now. You're not schlepping everything yourself.
Right.
And you also tout yourself as an all-woman business. But it's not just you, right?
I'm the only owner. So we are a Cook County certified women-owned business. I own the company 100%.
Okay.
Yeah. So I have women on the crew, and I have...
And men on the crew.
And
as
men
well.
On the crew. Yeah. The crew is mixed. It's mostly men. It's definitely a job that requires people to lift.
Yeah, you're going to have a strong back to do this, aren't you?
Right. I mean, you do. You need to physically take care of yourself and know what you're doing. We talk a lot. We do the initiation of how do you lift? How do you tell the other person who's lifting with you if you're losing control? How to step away from a tote that might be falling? You know, that kind of stuff.
That's actually stuff I had never thought of.
Yeah, you know, and we've not had anybody get hurt. I've not had a workers' comp claim. I'm so grateful for that.
You may knock on my head for that.
Thanks, Mike.
Here you are in a car wash, and part of the reason is because what you're doing is collecting food scraps. Now, I've been involved in some conversations about food scraps throughout the state and in Chicago. For several years now, and we just turned a corner back in 2010 when we made it easier to compost food scraps. The problem is there's still a lot of people out there who they're terrified of it. I mean, you know,
the yuck factor.
Well, and I was thinking about that on the way over. This is our problem. People are terrified of food scraps, and yet they'll put Roundup on their weeds or 2,4-D on their lawn, or they don't care about neonicotinoids killing off honeybees, but they're afraid of food scraps.
Right. I'm definitely a chemical-a-phobe, but there's a lot of people who are germophobes. I have to say, I work a lot with food scraps. We do a lot of zero waste events where I'm, you know, basically bussing and sorting food scraps. I'm not afraid of other people. I mean, it's so interesting. If you were sitting at a table with eight people, you would gladly take everybody's plate and walk to wherever the trash was or the bus tub was or whatever. But all of a sudden, once it gets to that point, people are like, it's scary.
I know. What happens to the food in that time?
I don't know. I mean, we're not a society of, you know, that has some dreadful disease that we're going to, you know, I mean.
Which brings us to the car wash, because you need a place to clean your containers. And you made it clear to me, you said, don't really let people know where this is, and I'm not going to. But again, that reflects that fear that people have, which is why you need your own facility where you can do this, and that's where some of that grant money comes into play, right?
Exactly. So I have seen some facilities along the way since I started searching about, I guess, 14 months ago now, that would have met our physical needs, but the expense involved of security deposit and the turning the utilities on and those things all require huge deposits. And it was like, I just wasn't like, I never really thought about that. You know, we have a nice month-to-month agreement here, and, you know, I'm glad to pay the owner for our two spaces that we use here. And it has a lot of potential. It's fine. It's a fine situation, except when it's really cold. Except I can't put any automation in here. And I think that the amount of time that
I should note that people are, you were washing, you had the big green gloves on, and like everybody else, you're washing by hand.
Everybody has the option to wear gloves or not wear gloves, whatever they're doing. That's kind of each person's personal choice. Obviously, it's not much different than washing dishes at home, and some people choose to wash with gloves on, and some people choose to wash without gloves on. I don't mandate how people choose to do that. When I work the zero waste events, I don't wear gloves. I just find them to get in the way when I'm trying to sort and stack. And
maybe that's a lesson for those germophobes and the people who are terrified of their own food scraps. Again, as you pointed out, they'll eat it on the plate, and the minute that it goes into the garbage, they think it changes into something horrible.
Right. And it's, you know, it's such a beautiful thing. It's, you know, it's got this beautiful nitrogen and all these wonderful things that the earth wants. It's just another terrific, amazing part of our food cycle. And, you know, it's a gift. It's a blessing. It shouldn't go in the landfill, and it's not going to make you sick.
Stick around for the second part of our conversation with Earlene Howard at the car wash right after this.
Captain's log, stardate 42326.1. The Enterprise is under attack by an apparently hostile life form. Mr. Worf, status report.
Inexplicable, Captain. They appear to be perambulating vegetables. We are being stalked by stalks of asparagus.
That is incorrect, Mr. Worf. Asparagus officinalis, or killer asparagus, was the subject of a very popular 21st century tome by the brilliant author Mike Novak.
Mike Novak. I'm familiar with his work.
Mike Novak was one of the smartest, funniest people in the horticultural world of the 21st century.
Sound red alert. Shields up. Tell me more, Mr. Data.
He has been variously compared to Mark Twain, Dave Barry, and Edgar Allan Poe.
Edgar Allan Poe, author of my favorite children's stories.
Captain, I am attempting to access a copy of the masterpiece. It seems to be available online at aroundtheblockpress.com.
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 Yes, Mr. Watt.
Yes, Captain. Aroundtheblockpress.com.
How many times can I say it?
Spending more time at home these days? Give yourself some room. Renovate your basement or attic. You'll increase your living space and your home's resale value, too.
Trust DR Services Unlimited, 847-998-1687 for your remodeling needs, including additions, renovations, and other home improvements. Rated A-plus by the Better Business Bureau and recommended on Angie's List. DR is a proud member of NARI. DR provides exceptional quality at a fair price. Contact DR at 847-998-1687 or at RestoreTheNorthShore.com.
And now back to my conversation with Earlene Howard from Collective Resource. And if folks want to get more information, they go to
www.collectiveresource.us.
And that takes us to what you had started to mention earlier, was a grant from the state that was going to help you. You've got two things going. You've got the award from Green America, which you should be seeing that money soon, right?
Correct.
But you're supposed to be getting some money from the state as well. What's happened to that?
Okay, so we were given a grant that by the Illinois Department of Commerce and Economic Opportunity in the spring of 2014. It was a grant proposal that me and a dear friend from church sat down and did. We didn't hire a professional grant writer. The fact that we got funded was kind of amazing. And it was to purchase another cargo van and to buy 100 more 32-gallon totes for us to continue to collect from restaurants. And then it was also to put in a commercial-grade dishwasher. And so we did implement getting the truck and the 32-gallon totes, but since we hadn't found a space to put the dishwasher in, the grant, all of the grants got put on suspension on March 31st, and that's where they still sit. And it's kind of interesting because when you're writing a grant, they give you like a back date. Like when I was writing the grant that was due at the beginning of December in 2013, they would let us backdate expenses all the way back to July of that year that we could include in the grant. But now that they've put this funding on hold for...
And when you say they, you're talking about the state of Illinois.
Yeah, it was the governor that...
I.e. the governor.
Yeah, he's, you know...
Governor Rauner, for those of you who are not familiar with Illinois politics.
And so he pulled all the grants, put them all on suspension. And so even if I, with my own resources, decide to set up this dishwasher now, if I do that on my own accord, they're definitely not going to pay for the dishwasher at all. So now I just have to wait for them to make a decision, and if
they're... Right, so they, owe you the money. They said they would pay you the money. They put it on hold. Are you afraid? What do you mean when you say they won't pay for the dishwasher?
So there's a very, there, I would probably guess with the things that I understand right now that there's probably like an 80% chance that they're not going to give us any of the money.
So that it...
At all.
Sorry.
Sorry.
Yeah.
We changed our mind.
It basically. But what's really bothering me is, you know, let's say I go to Chase and I get funding that I can actually...
You mean a loan.
A loan, right. Where I can actually get the dishwasher going on my own. They're saying that even if they say, sure, we're going to give you the money now, I will have disqualified myself from getting the $29,000 that's left on my grant by buying the equipment on my own.
The equipment that you asked for in the grant.
Exactly.
Wow, that's what we call a catch-22.
Right. Well, I mean, it's just a screeching halt. It's not even saying, well, sorry, we can't really fund this. They're saying we possibly aren't going to fund this, probably aren't going to fund this, but if you go ahead and do it, we're definitely not going to fund it.
All right. Well, leaving that aside, for folks who want this kind of hiccup, can anybody call you and do this? But from what you and I have discussed in the past, it kind of depends on whether they fit into your routes, the way you've got them structured right now, correct?
Right. So there's a lot of neighborhoods that we go into weekly. There are some neighborhoods that we only go into every other week. So,
give folks an idea where you go.
We start like at 22nd Street, South Loop. And we go over to Pilsen, and then we go up all of the neighborhoods just west of 94. We do Bucktown and Westtown, and we work our, that's one part of our run. And then we do everything from that point east to the lake, and we go up to up to where 90 and 94 split. And then we pretty much stay east of 94. And we do all the north suburbs up to Lake Forest.
Wow, you've really expanded this business.
Yeah, so we have, like today we pulled 5 runs. So 2 of the trucks did doubles, meaning that they had basically one stop where they went for a large customer and picked up probably about a ton of food scraps, maybe a little bit more. And they did, 2 of the trucks did that twice today.
Is anybody in the country, obviously nobody else in this area is doing this, is anybody else in the country doing anything like this?
Well, I think it's mostly relied on the municipalities to
do it.
Well,
obviously, we can't even get the city of Chicago to pick up yard waste, okay?
Right.
So what makes you think they're going to pick up some food scraps?
Yeah, when I was saying I'm going to do this, they're like, well, aren't you afraid the city's going to put you out of business, that they're just going to do it? And I was like, I'm not really concerned about it. I'm in my mid-50s. I think by the time the city figures out what they're doing, maybe they'll hire me as a consultant or I'll be ready to retire. You know, I often think about a second market in a nicer climate, so I always feel like...
Have you actually looked into that? Are there cities where you might set this up?
I haven't looked into it because I really feel like I have a lot of work to do here. And it's keeping me very busy. But, you know, I've developed a set of skills. I have a lot of resources. And if they're not needed or wanted here, they are needed and wanted somewhere else.
What about the new proposed composting law? Do you think that'll affect you at all?
I don't think it's necessarily going to affect me much. I mean, so the urban compost bills, that's what you're talking about.
Right.
Yeah, so I think it's great that the community gardens and the urban farming, that they're getting to produce the food, the compost that they need on site. I think it's amazing. And I think that there will be some collaborative neighborhood ability to drop off, or maybe even other people running around and collecting.
But of course, those are for people who have yards and have a place. Well, even if they don't have yards, some of the rules will allow you to take food scraps to community gardens as long as they don't leave that site.
Right. So I think that, you know, it is designed to create compost for that particular situation, for that particular farm or garden. And I think that's great. There's a lot of food scraps. There's a lot of work to do. I don't really see it being, you know, a competition to the work that needs to be done. It's just another model. And there's room for lots and lots of models.
Because there's lots and lots of food scraps
there
out there.
And the more, I mean, I think that I have probably done the most education in Chicagoland about the subject as, you know, to just the general public about why it's important to divert your food scraps.
So why hasn't Rahm Emanuel called you to sit you down and figure this out?
You know, I don't know. I mean,
I don't know. Nobody knows.
I mean, I think it's, you know, it's obviously much more on his radar screen than it was, you know, 2 or 3 years ago. It's on everybody's radar screen much more than it was 2 or 3 years ago.
My take on this is to tell people, don't be afraid of your food.
Right.
Yeah. How do we get people not to be afraid of their food? And one of the ways is to turn it over to you, I guess.
Right. And, you know, I mean, it definitely takes some management to keep your food scraps, you know, where you're not throwing them in a plastic bag and then putting them in the garbage can behind your house. You know, in the summertime, you might want to refrigerate them or freeze them until it's closer to pickup day or when you can take them to your community garden. You know, if you leave food scraps out, especially in the summertime, yeah, you're going to have a fruit fly problem, but you don't have to leave them out. It's not, you know, and
your containers are closed, right?
Right. So if you want, I mean, a lot of people keep their 5-gallon bucket outside, but a lot of people keep their 5-gallon bucket inside, and then they just keep their food scraps in their refrigerator as long as they can till close to pickup day, and then they put it in the bucket when we're ready to come and get it. We have a lot of customers that only get a pickup every other week, which is recommended for a family of two. And so, I mean, obviously, if you put fish in the bucket on the first day and you're trying to keep it in your kitchen, you're going to have an odor issue. But there is so many ways to work around not having an odor issue. And, you know, carbon really helps, paper towels, you know, anything that, you bring home food from, some place in a paper bag, you can just add that layer to your compost bucket, and that really has a lot of positive effect on no odor.
Well, Erlene Howard, congratulations so far. I know this is it's an uphill climb, but you're doing great work, and this is really important for the city of Chicago and for the area and for the state of Illinois and for the country. Congratulations on your award. I hope you get your grant, and I'm going to take some pictures here.
Okay, great. Thanks so much for coming and talking with me today, Mike. I really appreciate it.
Always a pleasure.
Hi, I'm Peggy, and I've got great news about Natural Awakenings Chicago. We're now available throughout the city and suburbs, from Lake County to the Indiana state line. So if your sustainable business is anywhere in Lake or Cook County, we want you to be part of our magazine. Each month, more people turn to Natural Awakenings than any other magazine to help lead happier, healthier, and greener lives. If you own a green business or offer healthy living or wellness products and services, you should be working with our marketing team to get your message out to our targeted audience. Natural Awakenings is distributed in more than 1,000 Chicagoland locations, and our readers are looking for products and services just like yours. Join us, won't you? We're online at nachicagonorth.com. Call us today at 847-858-3697. That's 847-858-3697. Natural Awakenings. Feel good. Live simply. Laugh more.
You can have a beautiful lawn and be kind to the environment by using an organic, slow-release fertilizer like Milorganite. More than 60% of the nitrogen in milorganite is water insoluble, and it's delivered to the roots via microbial activity. Microbial activity occurs when soil moisture is adequate and soil temperatures are between 55 and 85 degrees. When conditions are not favorable, milorganite's nutrients stay in the soil until conditions are right for root uptake. Milorganite for better results naturally. Visit milorganite.com. MILORGANITE.com to find a garden center near you. Meteorologist Rick DeMaio in 30 seconds, so stick around.
Could an app be the answer to a better garden? Absolutely. It's the new free app, Homegrown with Bonnie Plants. Note, track, and photograph your garden's progress. Personalize your weather and reminders. Get variety info, grow guides, hands-free dictation, and more. The Homegrown with Bonnie Plants app, the sharpest tool in your garden. Download it free on the App Store.
I can't stop the rain. Can't stop the rain from falling down.
Well, it's been a while since my favorite meteorologist, Rick DeMaio, has been on the program. I miss you, Rick.
Yeah, well, that's what happens when the Blackhawks play into middle of June, right? We have other things to keep us occupied.
Yeah, I guess. Although when they had the big celebration at Soldier Field, all I could think of was how to stay away from it, how I could stay as far away from it as possible.
All right. I was actually on the corner of Madison and Des Plaines, and I was about 15 feet from the cup as it passed by. It was kind of nice to see.
Good. You represented me. There you go. And a lot has happened in the climatological world, shall we say, since you and I last chatted. Among the things that has happened, and I hardly know where to start because there's so much going on, but we'll cram as much as we can in here in a few minutes. The first is a new analysis by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, saying that perhaps the plateau that we had in the warming of the Earth was not real because of the way they took data. They're sort of backtracking on that and saying, no, the world's been getting warmer steadily in a way that is not reflected in the data we had before. And yet, you and I have chatted about this. You take a little bit of issue with this.
Well, I think if you look at the actual report, and oftentimes the report will get, you know, kind of watered down or kind of squeezed into different, you know, blogs and websites. I've read the report, and, you know, it's true, and I have to say I'm kind of surprised by it because the data has been out there for, you know, what, almost 10 years now, that there's been this plateau going on, and there's been many reports written about why and what is the cause of this, yet all these reports never really went after maybe the fact that the data that was being used was kind of suspect. So that leaves me with a real, you know, it leaves me with a hole in my stomach here because, you know, we're supposed to be scientists that are objective, but yet it becomes more and more difficult to be objective if the data that we're, you know, looking at and digesting and formulating our own opinions and then advocating from this, we find out later is not really good data, and that leaves me you know a little bit disconcerted about the science of observing you know large scale you know temperature data, and one of the things that we have to make sure that your audience understands is that it's not so much that the sensors that record the temperature were deemed to be inadequate or unfit for scientific usage, but the way that they actually figure out what's called the anomalies. And the anomalies is basically, it's not an observation, but it's a product. And the difference between that is that an observation, you can see something. A product is the difference between two observations, okay? In other words, a byproduct. So the product, which is an anomaly, is based on how they actually used a scientific, or I should say a mathematical calculation, namely statistics, to use or to correlate these anomalies in areas where they didn't have data. Remember, you know, 70% of the Earth's surface is water, and most of the data that we're getting is coming from satellites because you can't have ships everywhere. But some of the information we're looking at is that the difference between the ships and the buoys may be a little bit more different than we thought. And the spatial analysis, in other words, these large areas that they have to kind of figure out what's in between these large gaps, they used a different set of mathematical tools to figure those anomalies out, and they realized that the ones that they were using weren't as good as the ones that they have now, and therefore the anomalies don't seem to be as low as what they previously were. So it kind of makes you a little bit, you know, reticent on professing anything that you sometimes hear a trend is going up or down, then you have to start to question a little bit. So, yeah, it's a little bit disconcerting there from a standpoint of me professing what I believe is true science information.
The point, though, I think folks should know is obviously you're not a climate change denier by any stretch of the imagination. And one of the things we talked about several months ago was the idea that even if there was a plateau, even if there was a hiatus in warming, that was not a good thing, and it really didn't change the overall outlook of what the planet.
Exactly.
And explain that briefly, because you said basically that even if we were in a plateau, that means we plateaued higher than where we were before. So
exactly, yeah. It's kind of like you get to the top of the mountain and there's no more mountain, it's just flat. But you're still 8,000 feet above sea level. it's not like you went down on the other side of the mountain. Uh-huh. And this has been the case because if you look at the amount of energy that's stored up in the oceans, there's so much of the surface of the oceans globally that's showing above normal temperatures. It really gets to be a little scary after a while when you look at these large blobs of, you know, above normal temperatures. And part of that, the result has been, you know, this anomalous weather pattern that we had across North America last year with, you know, warming across Alaska, 2 years in a row, drought in California, you know, deep trough in the eastern half of the United States. That pattern really hasn't gone away, as evident by our somewhat below normal spring and early summer. It's been rather cool, and the Great Lakes are as cool as they've been in the last 6 years. You know, some new data came out and shows it's been the coolest since 2010, and every time we get a wind off the lake, it's cold around here. It's not cool. It's cold.
Yeah, well, folks who are listening in other parts of the country won't understand when Chicagoans are bemoaning the lack of a summer. Here we are getting close to the end of June, but that's the anomaly that we have here in the Great Lakes. Other people may be having higher temperatures. In fact, there's reports saying that the first few months of 2015 are on their way to record warmth.
Yeah, and it's interesting because when you look at that, most of it, you have to separate global temperatures from land temperatures. And yeah, when you look at temperatures across much of the Earth's surface through the first 5 months of the year, there has been large amounts of warming, particularly across western Canada, northern sections, well, most of Alaska, most of northern Europe. And the cool spots have been primarily over the Rocky Mountains, where there's been significant amounts of rain, and across the western half of the Midwest and also down into Texas. But by and large, most of the Earth's surface, particularly the oceans, the eastern Pacific, the area where you have the El Nino Southern Oscillation right along the equator to about, say, 15 degrees north to about, say, 10 degrees south, and from about 150 west to about 80 degrees west, that entire area was generally about a degree and a half to almost 2 degrees above the 20th century average. And now we're talking about this could be one of the strongest El Ninos since 1998. But when you look at the amount of surface area of water that's above normal, pretty much globally, it has added to that warming trend that we've seen from January 1st through the end of May. And as you mentioned, on track to eclipse what we had in 2014, which went down as the warmest year ever. But you know, there's still 7 months of data between June and the rest of the month, or the rest of the year, rather, to get through before we call it the warmest ever.
We're talking to meteorologist Rick DeMaio. Let's see. Let me very briefly go back to the El Nino. Some people are calling it a super El Nino.
I hate that.
I figured you did. I figured that was something that you would hate. All right, why do you hate that?
Well, define super. when you hear super, what does that mean? Is it Superman, you know? I don't understand why you have, I mean, that I would never use that.
All right. How would you characterize this El Nino? You said it was
a strong El Nino.
Okay, strong.
Yeah. And part of the reason why is when you look at it in comparison to past events, the amount of warming, in other words, I should say the intensity of the anomaly, you know, a degree and a half, 2 degrees, the period of time, and also the spatial area. So those three things is putting us definitely in the top five since the late 1970s, and most likely could eclipse what happened in 1998 and also in 1982. The odd thing about it is the timing of it is happening in the middle of summer, and as I mentioned, these types of events, when they happen in the summertime, you're always going to have, you know, the surface temperature of the water being generally a little bit warmer in the summer. But this is actually adding to it. So what the belief is now is that this can have a significant impact on what our upcoming fall and winter would appear to be.
You know what, Rick? Which, it just occurred to me, this is a super El Nino. Sorry.
It's a super duper El Nino. How about that? We'll make it sound even better. Super duper El Nino.
But you're saying it's coming at the time it does. It's like leading into a punch, you know. It's water.
Exactly right.
Yeah. Water's already warm and now we're getting this buildup.
So if you're taking your hand and pushing it up against the wall, essentially what happens with the strong El Nino during the wintertime. In the summertime, because the temperature of the northern latitudes already warmer, when you push up against that wall, the wall really doesn't have a lot of pushback, so you don't get that stronger jet stream, which is one of the reasons why strong El Ninos typically enhance what's referred to as the subtropical jet stream. That's the more southern latitude one. That's the one that generally tends to flow into California, parts of Mexico, into the desert southwest. Strong El Ninos generally enhance rainfall in the desert southwest and the Gulf of Mexico. In the summertime, they have less of an influence because you generally don't have that type of temperature and pressure gradient existing.
Uh-huh.
If you get a very strong El Nino, you can actually increase the amount of water vapor into Mexico, Gulf of Mexico, and the southern plains. But if your strong latitudinal winds begin to increase, you actually decrease the chances of getting a normal monsoon in the desert southwest. What happens is to get a monsoon, you generally tend to need a large area of high pressure in the upper levels of the atmosphere, and this allows moisture to be pushed westward from the Gulf of Mexico into the desert southwest. If you reverse the flow of air, you're taking all that precipitation or potential areas of precipitation, and you're pushing it further east. So, oddly enough, most people think, wow, warmer waters, more moisture, you would increase the chances of a desert monsoon. But actually, that's not the case. You would actually decrease it. And what happened about a month ago was the western edge of the El Nino typically allows a very large area of high pressure to develop over the sea, over the South China Sea, which extends westward into the Bay of Bengal. Once that area of high pressure develops, it basically keeps the northward movement of the Indian monsoon at bay. And with that monsoon being delayed by about 2.5 to 3 weeks, what ended up happening in India, they ended up having temperatures anywhere between 110 and 115 degrees, and that's one of the reasons why they had this devastating heat wave that killed 2,500 people, which I must say, Mike, was largely unreported by the mainstream media on the nightly news. This was a natural disaster. You had 2,500 people die in a heat wave in India, yet you rarely heard about it on the news. I guarantee if this would have happened in Germany, in France, in Spain, in the UK, it would have been on the news every night. It would have been the lead. And that kind of bothers me a little bit. And that's what one of the reasons why I think when the Pope issued his statement this week, he basically said that, look, you know, these are the things that are happening due to the Earth's warming, the climate changing. There are countries out there, developing countries with, you know, large populations that have already stressed out their resources, and it's up to the Catholic faith to understand that these changes are occurring already, and it's up to the Catholic faith to then make a more concerted effort to reach out and help those in need due to these type of climatic changes. And that's all he was saying. And when you really look through what he said, he basically took what the church believes in and just basically advocated it much stronger using scientific evidence as a basis for his report, or the report from his office, I should say.
Well, always great talking to you, even when you decide to take on Noah and the people who like to call things super El Niños.
Yeah, I still don't know who's calling it a super El Nino, but bottom line, though, I think if we want to talk quickly about our weather here in the Midwest,
sure.
4.5 inches of rain officially so far through the first 20 days at O'Hare, but when you look at the rest of the state of Illinois, anywhere between 6 and as much as 10 inches of rain have come down since the 1st of June, an additional 6 to 8 inches since the 1st of May. So we're looking at nearly 12 to 15 inches of rain since May 1st in what's called the Corn Belt. And looking at some of the Illinois farm reports from the last couple of days, the farmers are getting a little bit antsy about this. The remnants of what was Tropical Storm Bill produced incredible amounts of rain across central Illinois in the areas where they did not need it. We've had 3 hurricanes in the eastern Pacific Basin. That's the area that lies generally south of Mexico to about Central America. We have Hurricane Andres, Hurricane Blanca. Both of those reached Category 4 status. When Andres developed, that was the furthest north that a Category 3 has developed ever this early in the season. When Blanca became a Category 4, not only did it become a Category 4, but it weakened to a 2 and then went back to a 4 again, mainly due to the fact that the ocean temperatures in that area are running between 86 and 87 degrees Fahrenheit. That's incredibly warm, way too warm for this early in the year. Right on the tail of Blanca, we had Hurricane Carlos that ramped up to a Category 1. Moved onshore into Mexico, and we've already seen very, very significant amounts of moisture come onshore into central Mexico and the southern half of the United States, particularly Oklahoma and Texas, which saw not only 15 to 20 inches of rain in the month of May, which was a record, but, Mike, that turned out to be the wettest month ever for the history of the United States, dating back into the late 1860s. That's pretty amazing stuff.
Wait. For the whole country?
For the whole country, yeah.
Wow.
So May 2015 turned out to be the wettest month ever for Texas and Oklahoma, but it turned out to be the wettest month ever recorded in the history of the United States. And now you're talking not just 2 states, but literally for the 121 years of data, We've never seen we've never seen that much prolific rainfall. And Texas, as you know, is a pretty big state.
Yeah.
So to get that much rain, now while that was happening, Alaska had its warmest May ever since 1918. And then what happened this past week with Tropical Storm Bill forming in the Gulf of Mexico, you had an additional 4 to 6 inches of rain move right up the heart of central Texas and also up into Oklahoma. So they can't buy, you know, a 2 or 3 day period of dry weather. And what's amazing about this, Mike, when we really talk about the extent of climate change, it was only 3 years ago that they were experiencing a 2 year drought and heat wave where they basically culled nearly a million head of cattle because there was not enough water to feed them. Now the cattle ranches are complaining about this proliferation of flies because there's no place to put the water.
All right. I want you to give me the go green or go home finish here. All right. You know how that works. I say go green. You say go home, right?
Yeah, yeah. You can, yeah, let's practice it once and then we'll do it, or you just want to just nail it.
we'll just nail it here. I say go green or
go home.
You can find more information about the Mike Novak Show at MikeNovak.net. That's MikeNowak.net for links, photos, and commentary.